Welcome to Objects in This Review, the podcast where men talk about the paths our lives take and what we hope to see on the roads ahead. In this episode, we speak to poet Danielle W.K. Lee. Danielle and I went to NYU together in the late 90s. But in my memory, our connection and friendship didn't grow until after college, as we met again and again in the world of queer poets of color in New York City. Danielle is an incredible poet. I not only love and support his work, I study it. The conversation I intended to have with Danielle here was one about what it means to be an independent artist these days, but it turned into so much more. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. This is Objects in This Review. Thank you for doing this, Danielle. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
You are one of my favorite people, one of my favorite poets, and I would love to sort of like start this conversation with you by sharing one of your pieces.
Yeah, great. Again, thank you for having me on. I'm so excited. Your first pod was great, at least what I've heard so far. This poem is called Furnish. It's from my book, Anatomy of Want. What are you doing here, boy? When there are men out there whose pockets are train rides to Tripoli, antique carpets in the souks of Marrakesh. You are like clockwork, fading hours beneath my hands, keeping me and my poverty's company. So why not any of those architects of sonnets or prodigies of song willing to exonerate you from death? I, artless with verse, affording little in the visible world, have only this. If you have nothing, no house, no shadow, and I, no house, and only a shadow, should I give you my shadow, make it your home?
Beautiful, beautiful. From Anatomy of Want. And this is your first collection?
It is.
You know, when I was thinking about doing this interview, I sort of was sort of like thinking back to like how I know you. And in my mind, you were sort of like always in my poetry life. Like I was like, we must have like met in like queer poetry land. But then I was like, wait, we went to NYU together. Like we were like babies in the 90s at NYU in the late 90s, which I think is the best time to be at NYU.
Absolutely.
What did you major in when you were? I was like journalism and Africana studies. What did you major in when you were at NYU?
Well, I went to the school Gallatin, which is the school of individualized study. So we is a kind of create your own area, concentration of study. So what I did was kind of ambled along for the first 2 years or whatever. At first, actually, I wanted to be a photography major. And that's what I kind of, when I applied for NYU, that's what I said. I was like, photography. And then I realized that I'm not that great at it. I mean, I'm good, but it wasn't really where my heart was, I think. Also, we don't really talk about this as much as artists, but you know, there is a kind of class divide in being able to produce work, right? And writing poetry is one of the most democratic economically in a way, right? You just need a pen or writing implement and a piece of paper, which can be a napkin, and you can just write it. So anyways, kind of that's a tangent. But I did visual art practice. So I did a lot of different kind of visual arts, painting, lithography, photography, even creative writing and cultural studies, cultural theory. So feminist theory, queer theory, all of that.
Now you say that, now I feel like I have like some vague memory of like going to like maybe a showing of one of yours connected with APA studies. Is that possible? Is that how we like cross paths?
I'm sure it was something. I mean, I very distinctly remember you up at a mic reading. So
a baby poet, God knows what I was even talking about.
Yeah, baby poet. So, I mean, that's, I'm pretty sure that's how I met you. I think it was after.
Yeah, I always just have you thoroughly in like my poetry world. And so I'd forgotten that like you were also part of my NYU world. How did you find NYU of the 90s? It's like such a mixed bag when I talk to other people of color who went there around the same time as I did.
I mean, I have a deep nostalgia for sure, because I think also my sense of New York now is so vastly different from what it is then. So and maybe I'm kind of cherry picking memories and kind of maybe sanitizing to a degree. But yeah, I loved it. I mean, it was grimy. It was still kind of like an exciting place. You didn't necessarily want to walk down 14th Street towards a meatpacking district because you don't know what was going to happen. I mean, I did it anyways.
One way or the other. I was like, or you really wanted to walk down it.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, I remember like walking down it and there was like, you don't really see like trans sex workers like hanging out at the church anymore. But that was definitely the case then. Or even my freshman year, I remember some students, people on my floor at one of the residence halls, we were thinking of like, oh, let's move out of the residence halls next year. And so we were we were considering moving to Chelsea at some point, but we were all like, oh, is that place safe?
And it's Chelsea, yeah.
Yeah, is that, yeah, it was just, it's really kind of funny. But yeah, I look at it very fondly. And as I go, when I'm back in New York, I think often of like how that New York is gone, not just the physical spaces. Yeah. But
I also have like a bit of a nostalgia about it. Like, you know, I have more opportunities to talk about how tough it was and like what the struggles of being like gay and Black at that time were. And I feel like a lot of my poetry is about that. But it was also sort of like a really magical time. A lot of art got produced. I met so many interesting people who were lifelong friends and inspirations. And I feel like I got to become an artist in a way that's, I think, almost impossible now. Like, I don't think people can imagine a pre-social media time of what it was like to like organically connect with artists in a way. Like, I just feel like that's disappeared in a way. How did you come to poetry?
Well, I really started writing quite young. I kind of been.
Where were you born?
Where was I born?
Mm-hmm. Like, where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Kuching, Malaysia, and my family were refugees from Vietnam. I'm like a third generation refugee. My grandparents on both sides fled China during Japanese occupation, I believe, and went down to Vietnam and then fled during communist revolution. I was born in Malaysia. We had gotten sponsorship, went back to Vietnam, and then came to the U.S. And I was around a little older than maybe one or maybe 2 years old. And then raised outside Chicago. And that's where I was for up until going to NYU. And I started writing as early as like writing poems as early as fifth grade. I was writing little very saccharine, rhymy poems.
About what was young Daniel writing about when
I
he was
wrote
10?
Two poems to a girl named Maria Paganiban. I'm putting her name out there. She knows. It's fine. She doesn't care. Because I've told the story a few times. But yeah, I wrote a couple of poems to her. And those were, fifth grade. And then I think sixth and seventh, I did something similar, which I wrote poems for my guy friends to give to their girlfriends. You know, whatever girlfriends are in sixth and, or seventh and eighth grade or whatever.
This sounds like a 90s rom-com, a coming-of-age story.
Cyrano de Bergerac, kind of, yeah, it's kind of silly. Because, of course, I mean, like, what did I care about, you know, girls, really? I'm, like, pre-gay days, ostensibly.
Your burgeoning gay days.
Yeah, before the tiara was put on my head. I mean, I don't even know why I even did that. I don't think I was asked, necessarily. That's, like, cloudy in my head. But yeah, I was just always been kind of drawn to that. And then by high school, we had a poetry club at, and so we would come back to the school. I think it was on a Monday night at like 8 o'clock or something, or maybe 7 o'clock. We'd come back to the school and it was led by one of the English teachers. And we either shared poems that we had read that we liked with other students, or shared poems that we were writing. And kind of
did,
like,
you always think of yourself like as a writer or a poet, or did you think of yourself like, and let me know if this distinction doesn't make sense, but like for a long time I considered myself like a writer, and then at some point I was like a poet, and then at some point I'm like, oh, I'm an artist. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of like wondering like when poetry went from like a hobby or like a casual form of expression to like something a little bit more that you thought was like worth time.
I don't think I ever made a distinction between at least a poet and an artist, because I think literary arts is very much a artistic discipline. So I don't think that as soon as I kind of had an identity as a poet, I automatically consider myself an artist. I think maybe like one of the cues for me mentally was when I first got a poem published, and that was in high school. And so I think that it was in a way affirming to a degree where I could think of myself as a poet. And mm-hmm. at that age, of course, you're trying on identities, like you're trying on pants. So it's like that seemed to fit, and I kept on writing, so it seemed to stick. And I don't think I kind of let go of that, you know, ever since then. But because I've always been really focused on poetry, even though I do kind of divert in other areas, but it kind of goes back to poetry because I think aesthetically and what I'm interested in with language, poetry seems to be the kind of most apt modality for it, so to speak.
That's great, because that sort of like leads into my next question. I was going to ask you, why poetry? Like, what about this particular art form or discipline appeals to you?
Well, I mean, for me, creatively, as I produce it, which is to say, that's, I think it's different from what I might read or am attracted to, because those certainly can be two different things. I often like poetry that I could never really write. Not never, but it's not my kind of instinctual way of writing. But what I like in poetry that I create is kind of compression. I really love economy of language and maximizing meaning. So I like to say a lot with a little, and using metaphor and our kind of cultural baggage with language to really kind of exploit someone emotionally to feel something. Because I'm not interested, generally speaking, in like reading a poem and walking away cold. Like, I want to feel some shit, you know? And it could be different. It could be cadence of words. It can be all kinds of things. But I think and sometimes rhetoric or something simply said things can be very, very powerful too. But yeah, I'm interested in kind of gestures and succinctness, but a lot of kind of potency. What I kind of mean with like,
I think that comes through. Like, an I love Anatomy of Want. Perhaps you can relate to this. I'm in like a tiny New York apartment, so I tend to like get books, read them, and give them away. And if I keep a book, it's because it's something I'm going to read over and over again, and it has sentimental value. And like, your poetry book is one of those books that I'm like, oh. And I, you know, I don't actually read a lot of poets. That's not like what I read in my personal time. But when I find something that like opens my eyes to like the possibility of the art, I really cling to it. And for me, your work always does that. But like, what you talk about in compression and what you do with space and storytelling has always resonated with me. There's a poem that you have about jujitsu that like is like a short film in my mind. And like, it resonated. Partially because like martial arts is one of my pastimes, but like, you captured like the play, the intimacy, the double meaning, all layered, and you did it. And when you talk about like people like being attracted to like poems that like you aren't like a thing you would write, like that's what I was like, I could never do that. I can never do in that page. That would have taken me like a 3 or 4 pages to like come across like in constellation style. Like, it would have been that, but like, you captured that so beautifully. Can you tell me about like creating that collection and like what your intention behind it was? It's so like lush.
It's interesting because I was thinking about it just earlier that it took me about 15 years to write, between like the earliest poem that's included to the like the latest poem. We kind of measure time in that regard. And I didn't really have an intention. It wasn't like a project manuscript. I just started writing things, and then and part of it was my MFA. Like, I needed to have a creative manuscript to graduate.
So after NYU, you got your MFA at
the new school.
Not at NYU.
No. Okay. I did apply to go to NYU. I first for something until I was going to go back to Gallatin for a master's, but I didn't need to put myself in another whatever $100,000 debt. But
right, a house worth of debt.
Exactly. Yeah, it just kind of like the interestingly, the name of the book kind of came to me first. And mm-hmm. then I wrote the poem that's in the book after I thought of the name. And then, at least I'm sure that's how it goes in my brain. And then, yeah, it was just kind of, it just seemed to kind of fall under the rubric. What I do think is interesting, and I don't know if it was a conscious decision, that there isn't really a lot of, there isn't like a sex poem in there, not mm-hmm. not explicitly, right. but people tell me it's very sexual.
Yeah, I find a bit of desire or longing in like every piece, which is what I think I loved, how you layered that in intentionally or not. Like, it was so palpable in a way artistically. I'm as a reader. So like, great name and great, that's sort of like the magic. It's like, that is the great name for it. And like, you, it's much like anatomy. It's like, some things you see, some things you don't, but like, it all works together to create this experience that's like really genius.
I mean, I have to say that I'm a little bit Svengali about my, I would say like the creative package, and that, as you know about me, I'm not particularly shameless about like promotion or anything. And
no, you are the most hustling poet that I like. It is another thing that I admire about you. You hustle as a poet. You are out there poeting come hell or high water. I mean, so we'll talk about, since you brought that up, we can talk about sort of like your drive as an independent artist and like how that's developed and changed over time.
I think in part it kind of emerges from the fact that, and this is, I guess I'm a rarity, a little bit of a unicorn in this regard, that I don't really suffer from like imposter syndrome. I don't suffer from imposter syndrome. Maybe it's a little bit delusion that I'm just like, people should be reading my work. If they don't like it and they don't understand that, that's their problem. You know, I'm all about reaching audiences. And if, you know, if there are people who don't like it, that's fine. That's great. But it's not going to stop me from propagating and seeking new audiences and kind of doing it in the most interesting and compelling way possible. Like, I had a reading on Thursday and they were kind of like, well, we want you to put your book cover, you know, over here in this little spotlight. And so people are going to know about it. And I'm like, perfect. You know, I didn't say that, but I was like, perfect, because, well, I did say this before my set. I said, you know, like, even if you don't like my poetry, you look at my book cover. It's like, it's perfect for a coffee table book because the cover is really beautiful. It's very, it's titillating. It's suggestive. It's not explicit, but it's like, oh, you want to kind of look closer and you're just like, am I seeing what I'm seeing? Is that what's going on there? And yeah, it's kind of like this, again, this like intentional package, so to speak, that I'm not in any way, I don't feel shame or anything about like putting it out there.
Yeah. I love that you say that, because like I've had a journey with that myself, I think. My first book was called Reluctant Poet because that was my nickname mm-hmm. on the New York poetry scene, because I would like come to a slam, do my thing, and then disappear for months at a time. And part of it was just like my journey about like figuring out what kind of artist I wanted to be, but then also like whether or not I deserved the attention that I was getting. And I kind of sort of have my own theory about like audiences. And like now as like a grown ass man, I sort of have gotten more comfortable and more, I think, authentic and honest about like, it's not about like whether or not I feel like my work deserves to be read. It's like at various times, that's not super important to me. For the longest time, it was like, I just wanted to make shit that I like with as little influence from people as possible, because I'm like controlling. And then, I don't know, something about the last two projects, I'm like, no, I want a community of people to fuck with my shit, because this is good. This is like some good stuff. Yeah, I've had to like grow into that, and you've been like a great example and frankly friend in that, because like you've always championed my work in a way that like I feel like few poets have. Like you've always like welcomed me to perform with you and shared my work, but you do that intentionally. Can you talk about like why you do that? Like why you're such a fan of poets and like and the importance of like a artist community to you?
Yeah, I think that, well, I think this, you know, more recent times of discussing kind of the role of justice and all things in our society, even in culture, kind of put a spotlight in this, in, you know, what is actually problematic, which is kind of the business side, we'll say, of the production of art and how it reaches audiences. And there is a role for justice in that regard. And individual artists have to play a part too, I think, in being able to not necessarily level the playing field, but creating interventions. So other poets of color, queer poets of color can find audiences. And I'm interested, I want to, my justice practice with respect to writing and audiences is to try to take my short, you know, time in the limelight to expose other writers that my audience probably haven't heard before. And why shouldn't they hear them? If the more popular writers in the world, and this is, it's not, I mean, I feel it's incumbent on us to do it. That's my personal feeling about it. But if other writers aren't going to do it, then, you know, it's on them. But I feel like they could, they don't need, you know, just to have it all on them 24/7 mm-hmm. or when it's on them. They can, you know, give 2 minutes and platform another writer. So
yeah,
that,
let's do some of that. Like what artists do you really like now?
I just had a...
Besides
you, obviously, I just interviewed the poet Chen Chen mm-hmm. for Saints and Sinners Literary Festival. She's one of these examples of a poet who writes so different from me and absolutely love. I describe it to him as kind of a profound levity. It's funny, it's light, but actually you're just, you read a poem and you're like, I just walked away like more wise or something. It's fantastic. Ocean Vuong, of course, he's just doing beautiful things with language. And I have such a bad memory. But there's such a selection. There's so many. There's also a lot of poets in New Orleans that I really respect. I really love their work. Nikki Umul, for example, and she's also an educator and is creating opportunities down there for writers as well. Charisma Price, oh my gosh, she's also a fantastic writer. Doesn't write anything like me, but really captures the spirit of New Orleans while just writing just reality. Like, you know, obviously her reality, but it has the incredible spirit of that city. It's so far my like book of the year, and it's only, well, now it's mid-year, but...
What's the name of the book?
Why I'm So Serious, or I'm So Serious. It's, yeah, absolutely everyone should read it. And it's just gotten a lot of attention, as it should. Yeah, Charisma Price with a K.
Can we talk a little bit about all the genius ways that you sort of like reach people? I want to like stay on your hustle for a little bit. And yes, the cover of Anatomy of Mont is quite sexy. Did you have any like conflict about doing that, or were you like bold, this is it, I'm doing it? Like, talk about the creation of the cover.
Yeah, I mean, I was very intentional. This photo is a photo from a photographer in California named Eric Schwebel. I knew there wasn't really a budget for this piece of artwork, so I paid for it. I got it myself, while our friend, you know, Shane Lucas, who designed the book, he was like looking for images, and I was like, I know I want that photo. So I reached out to the photographer and I procured it, and we incorporated it into the design. Yeah, I just had a kind of clarity when it comes to when I make something generally. And so, yeah, I sought out that photo and I was like, I want a visually compelling book, because the fact is, I don't need you to only like the substance of what's in between the pages. I need you to want to pick up the book. And if that means you just like the cover, what do I care if you don't like the interior? Because once you pay your $12.95, I'm going to get my cut. This is the marketer in me. I'm just
the
like,
marketer
you,
in you.
Yeah, just like, you're gonna pay it. I don't care. You know, like, it's not my problem if you don't like it. Not really. So,
yeah.
But you already paid for the $12.95 for the book.
Another thing that you do that I think is brilliant is that you have a Patreon.
Yes.
Where did that idea come from? Like, I've not seen another poet do it. And so maybe that's just like my small circle that's like unaware. But I was like, that's fucking brilliant to like reward people for supporting you with more of you. Like, I just sort of like, it's so simple, but it's brilliant. Like, how did you come to that?
Well, I think it's really obvious, because before there was Patreon, there were arts patrons.
Patrons, yeah.
So why wouldn't artists, writers even, you know, poets, why wouldn't we like use this platform to allow audience members who are invested in our work and really want to see it thrive, you know, put in the modest amount of money. It's like my levels are $5, $10, and $18. $5 is one person's very caloric Starbucks coffee. $10 is two of them, you know? And it's like, if you, you know, if you like my work, you know, it's not going to break the bank, generally speaking, to throw down $5 or $10 a month. And what it does is actually really important in terms of keeping an engaged audience for me, because that can pay, a lot of it has paid for, well, one, my website, the hosting of it, which is expensive, or can be expensive, and the travel. I mean, I've traveled to New York 3 times already this year. I'm here in San Francisco, and it doesn't pay for it all, but it definitely helps.
Makes it possible in a way that wouldn't be otherwise.
Absolutely. Yeah, it subsidizes it. So yeah, I don't see why not. Why aren't we considering ourselves, you know, in a way like content producers? We are creating content. It's just it's consumed in a different way. And I'm not saying that I have a whole, you know, shit ton of patrons, but I'm creating a space to allow people to support me. Yeah, I don't have any moral qualms about it.
Nor should you. That's beautiful. Another thing that you do that I think creates community and sort of like allows people to follow your journey is like I love whenever you share both acceptance letters when a poem of yours gets picked up, and rejection letters, and sort of like you're really transparent about like the process of what it means to be an artist or writer submitting stuff. And I love like whenever you get a rejection, you're like, that doesn't mean my shit's not good. On to the next. And it's so, even for me, who's like done this for a really long time, that's sort of like a great reminder whenever I can get wound up in what it's like to be told no in this world. Let me tell you, when I was like looking for an agent, and one of the agents told me I already have like a gay Black person on my roster, so no, that wound me up for like 2 years. Uh-huh. I was like on my fainting couch for like a really long time. I mean, you sort of always remind me of like not to take this thing so seriously, and also how it doesn't get in the way of like, it's not actually a judgment on my capacity to create art or reach people. That's not it. And so it really like has challenged me to change my relationship to that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's, you know, we have to also kind of recognize and understand that publishing, not necessarily writing, but publishing is a business, and it is imbued with the same kinds of, you know, social problems. And that's layered with our capitalism, where people and identities are commodities and markets or segments and everything. And so it isn't necessarily indicative of, yeah, your own ability to practice writing. And if anything, it allows, when you kind of see publishing for what it is, then it allows you to see your work as an intervention against this system of publishing that kind of is really set out for you to not be heard and not be recognized and not be accepted and or tokenized and kind of put in a box and saying, all right, you're just derivative of so on and so on and so on.
You're in a lane. You're a specific kind of product. You're on a specific shelf.
Yeah. And so, you know, fuck that and do it your way and use whatever tools that you have while you have them to do it. I'm not above posting thirst traps to get people to want to come to my readings.
and we thank you for your service. They are wonderful thirst traps, ladies and gentlemen. If you follow him for those alone, it will not be time misspent. What are you working on now?
I'm working on 2 different manuscripts, one tentatively called For Identification Purposes Only, which is a manuscript that is... There are kind of 2 project manuscripts, which is interesting because the opposite of what Anatomy of Want was, because they're intentionally kind of, there is a, you know, like this through line. And so For Identification Purposes Only is kind of focused on articulating ideas of justice and injustice through stories or narratives of people. And I can give you an example. I'll probably read for identification. I should learn how to you know, say this, the title of this poem and this book in general. But that poem is kind of like that was the tone setter for what I'm trying to do with the book. And then the second one doesn't have a title. It's mostly New Orleans centric poems. And for me, it's very important. I had to do this, to do that book. I had entertained upon the kind of urging of my or pressing by my poetry mentor from NYU and in life to see if I could reconcile them. But I decided to trust my gut and leave them
separate. Keep them separate.
Yeah. And part because for me, New Orleans, which is now my home, is a distinct cultural space, and it's really under existential threat, right? I don't know if it's going to be there in 100 years. And I find it important to myself, even emotionally, to find a way to be part of its cultural heritage, one way or the other. And I think creating the book, writing the book would be part of that. And I'm really proud of those poems because after I left New York, and I had moved to Seattle, I didn't really write. I wrote like 5 poems in 5 years while I was there, and I just wasn't creative at all. When I moved to New Orleans, it like was a light switch. I had written 5 poems in 5 weeks. So New Orleans has kind of been fertile ground for me in terms of my creativity.
Beautiful.
So it's also a kind of homage to that city and its vibrancy. And
I can't wait to get them.
Yeah, I mean, I still have to finish writing them. But yeah. I'm hoping it'll take less than 10 years.
Yeah. So before I ask you to read another piece, I have kind of a compliment for you in a way. Because I know people like talk about inspiration and like, but I really sort of think like, to be specific with you, I don't think I've ever said this to you, but like, when I finished Objects in This Rearview Volume 3, Home, my team can tell you, I was like, this is it. I'm done. That's book 8. I've like told the poet story that I wanted to tell. I've sort of done, I've made an album. I've done the things artistically that I want to do. And I'm sort of like, I think I'm done, guys. And they were like, okay. And then, you know, I sort of think of art as always in conversation with other art. And sort of one of the seeds for my next book that's coming out pretty soon was Anatomy It Won't, because I read it and it made me like, the question that it sort of like spurred in me is like, what would I write about like if I wasn't so concerned with like this corner that I've written myself into and like what people expect of me, what parts of myself would I share, what would I play with? And so very directly, like that book and what you did with it, and even like seeing you read it with like so much intention and so much boldness and so much like, I think, bravery and like intimacy and joy, really informed like how I wanted to engage my art and was like very much a foundation for like this next project. And so I wanted to make sure you knew that, because you've been such a supporter of mine. And so I just sort of like hope you, when and if you get it, you like see your influence there, and that you're proud of it, because I really do love you as a person and as an artist, and I really thank you for everything that you've done for me. Like, there are times where like you've shared my work in just the moment that I needed someone to like champion my work, and like it's not like I ever asked you to or like you got anything of it other than being a good fucking person. Thank you, and so that's my compliment for you. I really appreciate you.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to read this. It's a new book, and then of course share some of it with the world, because I don't want to give the entire farm, but want to give them a taste so people are going to pick up your book too. No, that's amazing to hear, and like, you know, I love being kind of, you know, surprised in that way too. Again, because kind of how I think about my work in distributing it, so to speak, is that I'm sharing it, and you know, whatever sticks, it sticks. I can't control how people react to it. So it's really beautiful, and thank you for sharing that with me.
Yeah. Can you share another piece with us?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, again, it's the kind of titular poem for one of my next books. Who knows which one is going to get a manuscript, which manuscript is going to get finished first. It starts with an epigraph. Again, it's for identification purposes only. On November 24th, 2012, the Tazreen Fashions factory fire in Dhaka, Bangladesh, killed at least 117 people and injured over 200 others, making it the deadliest factory fire in the nation's history. What will they bury if we girls, slowly blinded by paisleys and pick stitches, are reduced to a threshold of charred stud earrings? In places with no addresses, we make dresses between walls spider-veined with cracks and held together with purchase orders. Earn in a month the American retail price of a bra by sewing necklines that flaunt clefts of breasts creeping upwards at every yet extinguished breath. The barred windows had long been death warrants when the fire signed them. A ventilation hole on the third floor pried open, Allah's mercy. Afraid of heights, I could have kept my cousin's company back inside the smoke and dust, crumbled arm in arm to our last words of Bangla. But what would my mother have buried if she could not distinguish my earrings from the others? Hope suffocated to ash. I did not jump to save my life.
Powerful as always. And like, again, so cinematic. You pack so much in. That was beautiful. Thank you for sharing it.
Thank you. Yeah, I think what I'm kind of in my head when I write things like that, I'm looking for like the signifiers, the gestures that like will do a lot of the work in between. I'm also interested in the silence. I think James Merrill said something like, you know, the silence between the words and or after the period, that's part of the poem too. So when it's actually during the pandemic when I was, you know, forced to read online, I became a better writer. It was kind of a big silver lining for me, learning to like slow down. And I was reminded like the silence is part of the poem. So let the silence resonate as you read. And that helped me with the reading part. But I realized that's also kind of like what I'm also doing when I kind of stitch images together, that I'm kind of like picking the right things so that you can fill in, your brain fills it in. And so it's like, it's gestural, but then impactful without having to be so verbose.
So I always end all of these interviews with the same question, and I'm dying to hear your answer. Daniel, what's in your rear view?
Well, I have two answers, I would say. One, I think I shared with you long ago. One is regrets. I don't really hold on to those. I think it's part of my like Buddhist practice. I don't really have regrets because I see everything as building me to who I am or who I'm becoming day by day. So I'm always leaving those, you know, these situations or these instances where I could have like been like, oh, that was kind of prime fuckery on my own part. So I always leave regrets behind. And also, it sounds kind of weird to say, I guess to a degree, but a friend of mine took his life a little over a month ago, and it is painful still. But recognizing that it is a thing that you cannot change, it helps you kind of let its pain kind of go as well. So I'm not letting his memory or anything go, but that clinging to wanting him to still be here, I'm leave behind. Because it's, I honor
the him. The idea that it can be different, like you're letting that go.
Yeah, I honor him by continuing to create art. And he was also a writer. He was a fiction writer and not just in Wallow, because he was actually a joyful person despite kind of how things had transpired. So
beautiful way to remember him. Thank you for sharing that too.
For sure.
I really do thank you for doing this. You are so special to me, and I cannot wait to share this conversation with the world such as it is, that whoever listens to this season two. Thank you so much.
No, again, thank you so much for having me. And you're already planning your second season, which is amazing. So, you know, like you two are making things happen and creating your own cultural footprint, which you should be doing. You're fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Objects in the Rearview. I'm your host, Travis Montez. Remember, the only reason to look back is to see how far we've come.